Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat political consultant Doug Herman, Republican writer and former candidate Susan Shelley, and Joel Fox, publisher of Fox and Hounds Daily website. And our program tonight coming to you from the Westwood One studios in Culver City, California, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, you can tweet us at btbdumont, @btbdumont. We'll be here for the next couple of hours talking about, we'll talk a little bit about domestic politics, a little bit about California politics as the program unfolds this evening. But of course, the big news in the world today is what's happening in Ukraine and in the shadows of the Olympics, and certainly those in Ukraine that decided to rise up against the leadership of that country and overthrow it. They certainly have redefined what the closing ceremony of the Olympics can look like, because they've changed the face of television coverage and everything else. And our guests this evening are going to offer their thoughts, and we want to get your thoughts as well, as to what we as a country, what we should be doing as it relates to that growing huge story, and what is likely to happen there when all the reporters of the world go their merry way after the Olympics close. Do we think that Vladimir Putin and Russia will be more aggressive in trying to do anything to undermine the people that have taken to the streets to throw the rascal out who is running their country? Joel Fox, thanks very much for Fox and Hounds joining us this evening. You normally talk about California politics and the relationship of business and politics in this state, but as an American looking at what is happening in Ukraine, should we be totally celebrating what the people in that country did to get rid of the despot who runs it, or should we be a little bit worried as to what Putin might do when the reporters all go their home?
Well, it's certainly a real world. In the real world, there's always pushing counteraction to what happened. I think it is something to celebrate. I think that the people spoke and ousted a president that they thought was taking them in the wrong direction. Obviously, those who were in rebellion wanted to have closer ties to the West, which means the United States, ultimately, although they're closer to the European Union. And the question about what Putin's going to do, of course, is unclear, but you have to keep an eye on him because of his history.
Doug Herman joins us. He's our card-carrying Democrat tonight. It doesn't appear to me to be coincidental, because for the last couple of years, and certainly the last several months, every single story or every single newscast led with the threat of terrorism on the Olympics. And everyone knows that Sochi was just filled with all kinds of Russian troops. And then coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, you have the uprising in Ukraine, which makes it very difficult for any additional troops that might have been asked to go into that country, to go into Kiev, to put down the demonstrators, as well as the world attention on the Olympics. It seemed to me that this is more than just a coincidental timing of this incident.
Well, there's been unrest and discord in that country for years. In fact, the last election was fought over ties to the East or ties to the EU and the West. Mm-hmm. And the leading opposition candidate was thrown in jail after that election. She was just released over the course of this weekend, and they appointed her ally to run the country. So this has been going on for some time, and Putin couldn't have done anything during the Olympics. The eyes of the world were watching him. He was personally probably distracted by what was going on within his own country with the Olympics and making sure that exact terrorist threat was not being carried out. And so when you look at what's been going on there for quite some time, I don't think it was time to coincide with the Olympics per se. I think they used an opportunity once this thing reached critical mass just ahead of the Olympics and got a lot of progress made in terms of throwing out the old government, but I don't think it was time to coincide with the Olympics per se.
Susan Shelley is our Republican this evening. Shelley, Susan, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Your reaction to what's taken place over there, and again, should we be celebrating this thirst for freedom and at least as we define freedom?
We should be. We should be celebrating it, and we should be helping them set up a constitutional republic, because democracy alone will not make them free. Democracy is just going to be mob rule unless they protect individual rights and they set up a constitutional republic, and this is the opportunity for us to help
them
with
that. Do you think
they're
going to ask us for that help, or should we just volunteer it?
Well, we could volunteer it as individuals, as you as a journalist and me as a writer. We could volunteer that help. We could send judges. We could send lawyers. The important thing, the mistake that's made in so many of these revolutions is that they set up a democracy which winds up being war by other means. And we don't make any progress. And unless we send U.S. troops to hold the sides apart, it's violence forever. And that's what we hope not to have in Ukraine.
But at least the preliminary discussions that I've been watching on the television throughout the last 48 hours is obviously you have elements of the East that are older and certainly are comfortable with Russia and Putin and their former president. And is this going to be another instance where a potential civil war might be on the horizon, Joel?
It's possible. I was thinking that, in fact, one of the ways that this resolves over the course of time could be a split in the country, an East and a West Ukraine. I also think that those in the West, probably would prefer their association more with Europe than the United States. When you bring the United States into the picture to help, then it becomes more, I think, of a threat to Russia. And remember that the
it brings up the Cold War mentality.
It does. Well,
which Putin already believes in.
Right. And note that the negotiation that got us to this point happened with foreign ministers from Europe. While the president offered his support for the change, it was foreign ministers from Europe who actually were doing the negotiation. And I think that's what they're more comfortable with of those folks in Western Ukraine.
So we've got to be relatively quiet and let this play out. Do you agree with that, Doug?
Well, this is really a place and a time where the EU needs to step up. This is in their backyard. This is something they should be taking responsibility for. They've started to do some of this, but they've got a history of backing away and not following through and not doing the things that are necessary in order to do their part. And this is just the same old thing we've been fighting for years. This is the East-West Cold War tensions being played out with Russia and the U.S. Through another venue in Ukraine this time, and the EU. They're both proxies, and we need to have other people involved with this thing. It can't be just the United States shouldering the burden here, and it's got to work with other people.
Susan, do you expect Putin to flex his muscles when the world press leaves Russia and do something to get back at those who overthrew his favorite president in Ukraine?
There will never be enough troops to hold down a population that wants to be free. If the soldiers in the Ukraine walk away and say, we're not going to defend that kind of thing anymore, we're not going to oppress people. Mm. If you have Chinese protesters...
Well, the police have already walked away.
They've walked away.
That was part of the reason why it happened so relatively quickly. Again, over 80 people died because of what happened in turning on their people.
If people want to be free, they can fight for individual rights, and they can set up a government that protects individual rights, and they will be free.
I'm Bruce Dumont. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you want to weigh in on what's happening in Ukraine and also offer your assessment of the Olympics, Putin, and what Vladimir Putin might do next on the world stage. Back shortly from Culver City, California. From South Bend, Indiana to Santa Monica, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We're going to talk about a variety of other things as the program unfolds this evening. And again, because we are doing this program from California, we're back in California this week for the next couple of weeks. We spent 2 weeks back in Chicago and spent the four previous weeks doing our show from Los Angeles, the Westwood One Studios in Culver City. And Susan, you are a Republican, and you ran for the Assembly here in California.
Yes.
In a district that has a fairly large Democratic base.
Mm-hmm.
And you ran and lost narrowly. What prompts a young woman to run for political office in California as a Republican when everything we have heard over the last 6 weeks on this program is that is a brand that is in deep trouble in this state?
Well, I got into politics after the top two primary was set up, which is a California reform that got rid of party primaries. What we were having in California, as we see in national presidential politics, is the Democrats run all the way to the left on the economy and the Republicans run all the way to the right on some of the social issues. And I felt I never had anyone to vote for. I am a fiscal conservative and a social moderate. And I felt that voters like me had to have someone to vote for. And that's why I got into politics. Also because things are not okay in California. Things are not fine in the budget. People are not working. Kids get out of college and can't find jobs. People are living in their parents' basements. Things are not okay.
Doug, as a Democrat, the way you do it in California, is that a model for the rest of the country? Is it good to have this top two concept? Or is it too early to tell whether or not it is going to bring to fore quality candidates?
I guess I have two views on that. It is definitely too early to tell, but if you look at the one election in which we have history on this, it worked really well for the Democratic Party. We were able to get supermajorities in the Assembly, in the State Senate. We defeated all the propositions on the ballot that were of interest to both of the parties, and we elected half a dozen new members of Congress. So in that context, it worked out really well for the Democratic Party, which may be indicative of how poorly the Republican brand is faring, or it could be an example of how well the top two primary works for the Democratic Party. But I really think it's still too early to see how this thing is going to play out.
And how does money play into this new system, Joel?
Well,
is it still the person with the most money is most likely to win?
Well, most money has a lot of influence on the process, but not necessarily. I think one thing to look at, and I agree with Doug, it's well too early, but let's talk about a study that's actually going to be released tomorrow. As you know, former Governor Schwarzenegger started an institute over at the University of Southern California. And he's having a conference tomorrow on his post-partisanship that he's always endorsed. And there's a study that's being released, part of that, by a USC professor that talks about the top two primary and is it making a difference here in California? This professor argues that it is making a difference. Again, let me just put the note in. I do agree with Doug. I think it's a little early to judge that. But he did his study based on some of those Democrats who were elected, are they more to the center? He used a California Chamber of Commerce table to make his calculations, and he found that when there was a contested top two primary between two Democrats, particularly one that was up in Northern California, where a more moderate Democrat won despite the establishment of the Democratic Party supporting the more liberal Democrat, that person voted a little bit more to the center, a little bit more with the Chamber of Commerce. Does that mean anything? Is it too early to tell? Yeah, I think it's a little bit too early to tell. But there is some indication that the top two primary may move some of the candidates, even though it's Democrat versus Democrat, may move a Democrat toward the center. Same thing on the Republican side.
Is there any lesson for those listening to this program from beyond California? Is there any lesson based on the way you do politics out here that should be replicated in other states, whether it's a top two primary, whether it's more propositions, whether it's a recall? All of these things, people who listen to this program who are not in California, they hear those words. They're associated with California. There's some really interesting things that have basically started in California and gone east, both good and bad, the country frequently looks to California for new ways to do politics.
Well, I think the message here is that message matters, that people do not always run against incumbents, and the election is over well before it ever gets to the
voters.
And
term limits is another California concept.
Yes, and that has shaken things up,
right.
and that has opened opportunities. And it has shown that the voters are not happy.
Is it good?
It can be good.
Term limits have been around for what? 10 years?
Since 1990 was the original term limit law, but it's been amended much more recently. So where the original law said you could serve only 3 terms in the Assembly, which is 6 years out here, and 2 terms in the Senate, which is 8 years, now you could serve in either house for 12 consecutive years. So someone would be sitting in one particular house for 12 years rather than having to leave after 6 or 8.
But as a longtime observer of California politics, there's enough information that you could make an assessment on that. The concept of term limits, which still sounds good to a lot of people living in states where they don't have that, like Illinois, have term limits been good for California, or have they forced people to to out of office that maybe were really good politicians?
Well, things have changed. The view of term limits in California have changed somewhat, where the voters have decided that there had to be an amendment to the original law to lengthen them somewhat.
I ran the campaign that passed the term limits extend or revision, the amendment that allowed 12 years in one office. And I think that what voters in California were looking for is they wanted term limits, but they felt that the term limits were too short. And 6 years in the assembly before you were compelled to shift over to the from the assembly to the Senate was too short a period of time, or vice versa, to go from the Senate 2 terms over to the assembly was too short of a period of time. People were concerned that they were office hopping and immediately campaigning for office. But I think the concept of term limits is something that has valid points behind it, and there's merit to it as long as it's applied equally. If, for example, we were to apply this to Congress, maybe we'd get rid of some of the logjam and the gridlock that's going on in Congress, and most of the people who are pushing that have a lot of years of seniority behind them, and if we were able to get some sort of a 12-year term limit or a 14-year term limit on members of Congress, that might be a really good thing for our country.
Well, something I heard last year from some of the Democratic candidates in the primary I was running in is that it was a 12-year seat because it was 12 years before term limits got them out. But it's not a 12-year seat. It's a 2-year seat. And the voters have a say every 2 years. And we have an obligation to put up candidates so that the voters, when they are not happy, have someone to vote for.
And in looking at the overwhelming Democratic support in the state now, again, I go back to my initial question. How can a Republican make a difference in a state that looks so overwhelmingly Democratic at the legislative level, both on who is sent to Washington? It's a little more balanced there, but certainly not those that are making the laws and controlling all of the legislative offices or constitutional offices in California. They're all Democrats.
Well, with 2 seats turning over in the Assembly, the supermajority would be broken, and we would put a stop to all of these abusive practices like spot bills, where they're passing blank legislation in the Assembly and sending it to the Senate. Something's written in a back room, it comes back, it's passed with an up or down vote, no amendments, no hearings. That's an abuse of one-party government. That's just not good government, no matter which party is in control. And when people hear about it, they're not happy, and they want it changed.
You know, there's been a couple of special elections since the last election, general election in California. Republicans won both seats. Now, I'll be the first to point out a special election has lower turnouts, and we don't know if there's a trend here. But what we did notice in those two elections is that you had a candidate for the Republicans who very well fit their particular districts. One was a state Senate seat. The other was for the mayor of San Diego. And they Republicans were better organized than they had been in the past. So is this some kind of a sign or a bell that maybe Republicans are learning their lesson and turning things around? We'll know better at the general election this year, because, again, a special election has different turnout patterns than the general election does. But there is a sign that if Republicans speak to the district with good candidates, they have an opportunity.
What is, looking into the crystal ball, Doug, what is the next big story of a national substance that you think is going to come out of the state of California? Something brewing out here that's well below the national media radar. Anything that jump into your mind? Any candidate, any name, any movement that comes out of the state?
Well, I was going to talk about the reforms that have been working here that are in California, and I think that the nonpartisan redistricting, which forces candidates to run in districts that are not of their choosing, has probably had the most impact on the congressional delegation, for example. We've lost half a dozen members of Congress this year, including two with some of the most seniority ever in the history of Congress. So part of what's going on there is that they don't want to run in top two primaries, or the districts are new and unfamiliar to them, and so folks are saying, you know, it's better for me just to take my time and stamp it and be done than to go on and continue fighting for these seats the way they have, because D.C.'s not working the way it used to, and along with the tough races they have to run, folks just aren't as interested in staying there.
Susan, on a policy matter, the way in which California is dealing with its prison population or overpopulation, is that something? First of all, how do you feel about some of those reforms that the governor is imposing? Much of them because of the federal judges are breathing down the state's neck.
It's horrible.
Are they good?
No,
the reforms
horrible.
Are not. What's wrong with the reform? What are the reforms and what's wrong with them in your view?
Well, a federal court said that California was not providing adequate, I believe, medical and psychiatric services, and it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And the governor, a law was written and passed in California called AB, Assembly Bill 109, which forces the release of supposedly non-serious, non-violent felons back into the community. Mm-hmm. And it's been a disaster. It's overburdened the counties terribly. They can't afford to house this prison population. They're not set up for this sort of long-term imprisonment in mm-hmm. the county jails. And it's been expensive and disastrous, and there have been a lot of crimes from people who were released. It should be repealed.
I want to talk more about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, talking politics tonight. Again, from the great state of California, I'm Bruce Dumont, back from Culver City in a couple of minutes. Skokie, Illinois to San Luis Obispo in California. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. 1-800-723-8029. Before I introduce our guests this evening or allow them to introduce themselves, let me mention for those of the last couple of weeks, I have been talking about an event that we had last Wednesday night at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It was a salute, an evening rather, with Dick Wolf, who is the executive producer of Law & Order and also Chicago Fire and Chicago PD, the new shows, hit shows on NBC, and the casts of those two shows, Chicago PD and Chicago Fire, were all in attendance at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. We had over 500 people in attendance. They were rocking and rolling. It was thunderous applause to all of the personalities that were there, and they were all very gracious. You know, it's nice that when you watch shows, I'm fans of both shows, it's nice when you meet the stars of those shows, and they turn out to be really nice people. And that was very warming. And again, if you go to our website, which is museum.tv, museum.tv, you can watch the entire presentation with all the stars of those shows on YouTube. Again, part of the YouTube channel at museum.tv. Around the table here in beautiful Culver City this evening, we have three guests. Let me introduce our Republican guest, and I'm going to let her introduce herself, Susan Shelley. Susan, tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm a writer, and I've written three books on the U.S. Constitution, and I got into politics a few years ago because things are not okay in California, and I felt that people had to get off the couch and get involved, and so I did. And a tremendous amount of support came to me. I got into originally a congressional race thinking that I would just talk about economic issues and educate the voters about another way of doing things in California, and I got the endorsement of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which is very important in California, mm-hmm. and the Los Angeles Daily News, and people came to me and said, you have to run for the assembly, and that's what I did.
You've also written a novel called The 37th Amendment. Tell us about that briefly, because you are making this book and some other books that you have written available to those listening to the broadcast this evening without charge.
Absolutely.
If they go to the beyondthebeltway.com website, they can click and they can get an ebook. But tell us about the 37th Amendment. What's the concept there?
The concept is, what would happen if the Constitution was amended to get rid of due process of law and just allow local governments and state governments to do anything they wanted to reduce crime on the streets or anything else? What if we got rid of due process of law and we take the story 40 or 50 years into the future and we see how it turned out, and then do the people of the future want to go back to the way we're doing it, or are they happy? If you could make the streets totally safe, but there were terrible, wrongful convictions, would people be happy with that, or would they want to go back? And I wrote this before all the terrorism due process of law decisions mm-hmm. happened, but it's all really the same information, because if people want to live in a free country, you have to have limited government, and you have to limit what the government can do to people, even though we bear a certain amount of risk with that.
Sounds like a great movie. I'm sure it's a good book, but it sounds like a great movie, too. Doug Herman joins us. He is...
I'm a political strategist. I grew up in the great state of Iowa, Hawkeye, and came out to California 25 years ago. I've been running campaigns for the intervening years, and I've been very happy and blessed to live here in California and have a wonderful son and wife.
Joel Fox.
I have about a three-decade rap sheet in California politics. Been a taxpayer and small business advocate, worked on a number of the ballot propositions that we've already talked about, ballot propositions in California, did work on not too many with candidates, did work with Arnold Schwarzenegger during the recall, and I have this blog called foxandhoundsdaily.com, which deals with California business and politics, and I guess since we're talking about novels, I have a couple of mystery novels that involve presidents and modern-day murder mysteries, and if you want to know about them, joelfox.com, you can find out about
And you're a baseball fan.
I grew up in Boston. I'm a Boston Red Sox fan, and we won the World Series last year.
In looking at, we're talking about other things that are happening in the, in the state of California. Of course, this program coming from Illinois, we should never be shocked when there's corruption in the high levels of state government again. But some major, there's been a lot of investigations of Sacramento for the last several years, and some indictments came down last week. What is the significance of them, Joel?
Well, I mean, the significance, of course, is the threat to the attitude of the voters toward elected government. There had actually been an upswing here in California. If you look at the polls, the legislature, which was down in probably below 10% at some point, has got up to 30-40% support from the voters in the polls. And all of a sudden, there's questions about elected officials, whether they live in their particular district, or this one much more severe, whether an elected official took bribes. And the indictments came down just yesterday, Friday, that they are going to have to face this challenge. Of course, this state senator and his brother, a former elected official, say they're not guilty. But you know, it's a threat to the integrity of the of our government, and that's important. On a more political level, I guess Doug could talk to this, representing some of the Democrats up there. In California, it's important to have a two-thirds supermajority if you want to control everything, because certain laws are in place, particularly tax laws. One of the things that Susan ran on is that you need two-thirds votes to pass taxes, and the Democrats have that right now. They could lose it if they lose some of these state senators. So on a political level, it's important. I think at a higher level of trust in government, it's also very important. And it is the headline story in California politics this weekend.
Is this a state that's people are really engaged in politics, Susan? Have they given up? Have they thrown up their hands? Whether they're left, right, conservative, liberal, they don't think they can make a difference anymore.
I think there is a sense of that. There's not a sense of apathy as much as there is disgust. And what I'm seeing is people leaving the state. They've given up on it, and they don't think it can be made better. And I'm not giving up on the state. I am not giving up on California. People are leaving. They're going to Texas and Arizona.
Why?
And
what is it about the state that makes it so impossible for them to stay here?
We have a regulatory climate that makes it impossible to start a business. And this, of course, when you don't start businesses and you don't have businesses growing and expanding, there aren't enough jobs, and it becomes very frightening to live in a state where you feel like if you lose your job, that's it.
Doug, do you agree with that assessment?
No, and I would offer up as an example, I would say the words Tesla, Google, Apple, HP. We can go on and on with huge, monstrous companies that started in California, were fostered in California, grew because of California, and are the heart and soul of California.
Why did they grow because of California?
Because California allows that kind of innovation, and it fosters that kind of spirit, and it does allow these companies to grow and prosper. And, you know, you hear a lot of talk from the Republicans in particular saying, oh, this state's a job-killing state, you can't do business here. But then you turn around and you look at all these places that are growing these companies, that these companies are successes worldwide. And so I just think it's not true, and there's a lot of mythology about people going to Texas and Arizona.
Susan, what about
true.
It?
Well, Apple has its headquarters, I believe, or its capital company in Nevada, so they don't have to pay the California corporate tax. So there are a lot of workarounds that large companies get and different breaks that the government may give them to stay in California. But for small businesses, it's a disaster here. And small businesses create the overwhelming majority of the jobs.
Joel, you're Fox and Hounds. It's about business and politics. Who's right in this discussion that you're hearing right now?
The businesses the large businesses start here are still here. However, sometimes they expand beyond here. Apple, for example, is opening up in Austin, Texas. They're bringing a lot of people there. We just learned last week that Charles Schwab, which is in San Francisco, he's not going anywhere. He's moving 1,000 jobs out of San Francisco. So there is
Why is he doing it?
Well, a lot of it is the cost of doing business in California. I mean, we are a high-cost state. It is true that in the polling or the studies that they do, CEO Magazine has always listed California last as a business-friendly state, so there are problems there. There are people who have businesses that aim at moving other businesses out of state.
Who is standing up for businesses then? Well, traditionally you would think it's only the Republicans. Is that true or not true?
You're starting to see some change. And I think I talked about earlier this study that's coming out tomorrow that talks about a Democratic assemblyman who voted almost 50% with the positions of the California Chamber of Commerce, as opposed to the person that he succeeded in the office who only voted 14%. I think some of that is the pressure that some of the Democrats are seeing about fear of loss of business, loss of jobs, because obviously we grow those jobs, we grow those businesses in California, we have revenue to do other things.
What political clout do the big players at Google and the Silicon Valley folks, what political influence do they have on state government and state initiatives out here, Doug?
They actually have more influence at a federal level than they do at the state level. Mm-hmm. They're smaller players on the state level, whether it's Facebook, Google, Apple, all of them. They're all smaller players at state level than they are on a federal level.
How come?
So their profile is much smaller than you'd expect.
How come?
I think they've always been
Do they throw up their hands when they talk about Sacramento?
You know, but some of their issues are federal issues.
H-1B visa is their number one
issue.
H-1B
is where I was going too. Yeah. I mean, that's the big issue. They want to get workers from out of this country into this country. That's a federal question. It's not a state question.
And how likely are they going to be able to do that without immigration reform?
Well, I think, you know, you see that they're supporting immigration reform. Mr. Zuckerberg from Facebook started a new political action committee, I think that's the correct word for it, in which he is trying to influence that issue, and he's talking to both Republicans and Democrats because he knows he needs the votes across the board to get it done.
There is a perception, Susan, that Republicans as a party, at least a national party, are standing at the schoolhouse door when it comes to immigration reform. Do you agree with that assessment? That's the question.
No.
I'm going to give you a chance to think about it because we're going to a break. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border tonight. From Culver City, I'm Bruce Dumont. From Youngstown, Ohio to Santa Cruz, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to some telephone calls now. Rob is listening to us in the great state of Carolina, South Carolina. Go ahead, you're on the air. Go ahead, Rob.
Hi. You know, hello. How are you?
Very good. How are you? Thanks for calling tonight.
Thank you. You know, I was listening to the past couple of days. They were talking about the California breaking up into several different states
mm-hmm.
instead of just one state of California.
Right.
And I was wondering, how is that going to affect the Electoral College.
All right, I'm gonna let Joel talk. We talked about that before we went on there, and that was the next subject we were going to move to. So give us a little background, Joel.
Sure.
Where the idea came from, and most importantly, how likely is it to happen? It requires congressional action, obviously.
It does require congressional action. You know, the history of California is ripe with efforts to break it up, back from when it became a state in 1850. The current discussion is about a ballot initiative that was filed by an entrepreneur in the Silicon Valley that would break the state into six separate states. He's actually named the states within the proposition. There's a state up north that's against the Oregon border, which he calls Jefferson. There's one near the state capital in Sacramento, which is North California. There is the Central Valley, Central California. There's a Silicon Valley, the state of Silicon Valley, where the author happens to live and which would become the richest state in the country because it includes San Francisco and Silicon Valley and Santa Cruz and areas around there. Then there's West California, which includes Los Angeles all the way up to Santa Barbara. There's the Central Valley, which would be Central California, and then South California, Orange County, and San Diego County. It's the brainchild of this particular person. He has to go out and get 1 million signatures to get it on the ballot, and then the voters have to vote on it, and then Congress has to say, yes, we want to do this.
Susan, is this a good idea?
No, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, would it be a better idea if it was two states or three states, or do you think it should be California as one state?
I don't think the rest of the country would tolerate more than two senators from California. That's my personal opinion, is that two is all they're going to give us.
However, there's a lot of politicians that would love to see six states because
right.
There's more Senate offices
right.
opened up.
Doug, is this a good idea?
It's got nowhere to go.
How about for political consultants? Is it good for you guys? No, seriously,
it's not good for us because this is a crock. It's an abuse of the initiative system by somebody that's got too much money to spend and is trying to make themselves relevant in the political process, and they're using the initiative as their toy. This is not going to do anything, and it's got no real merit other than to spark a conversation on a radio show like this. That's really its only value.
That's an important value.
That's very valuable.
We have time to fill.
We should make it clear to the listeners that he just got the okay to move ahead. He hasn't got one signature. Maybe he has one by today, but he needs a million signatures. Whether he's going to pursue this or not is still unclear.
And is this something that the newspapers in the state, if they have any influence left, would not like this idea?
They don't like the idea, but it's something fun to talk about, I suppose, so they all have an editorial about it.
Chris is calling from Salinas. I guess that would be Central California, right? KMJ?
Actually, I'm traveling to Salinas right now, but I am from the Central Valley, which is Fresno.
Okay, so that would be in the new central state of California, which would be probably the agricultural breadbasket of the country, right?
If it gets a little water.
If it gets a little water, yeah. You'd have to get your water
you'd have to make
a deal with the Silicon Valley folks to get your water. But go ahead, how can we help you tonight? Always good to hear from KMJ.
Thank you. Susan can probably weigh on this more than me, but I'd like to direct the question to Doug. Our state legislature, with their two-thirds majority, passed the bathroom bill, and Jerry Brown signed it. And I'm kind of in the dark down there in the Central Valley. I don't know much about it, but I'd like Doug to kind of recap it for America so they can hear all about the bathroom bill that many of his candidates, I'm sure, that he campaigned for, can justify and share with America what the bathroom bill
is. What is the bathroom bill?
It's the transgender bill he's referring to, where that someone can claim that can say I am of this gender and I can use that particular bathroom even though I was born differently, or I can be on a sports team. I could be on a sports team of a gender, different gender. That's what he's referring to.
And this is for schools, for children.
Yeah, right. And there is an effort to bring about a referendum, but we don't know if it's going to qualify yet. So it is currently the law. So Doug,
it looks highly unlikely that the referenda is going to qualify to get put on the ballot. And what happened here is, the legislature passed the transgender equality bill, and some folks didn't like it, and so they tried to referend it, and they came up, and they're running signatures. They filed signatures, and we're in the middle of a count on it right now, and we'll see what the likelihood of that is succeeding. Right now, I think projections are that it does not make the ballot.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much for your call. Susan, before the break, I asked you about a perception of the National Republican Party and Congressional Republican Party that they are standing in the schoolhouse door as it relates to immigration reform. Do you agree with that assessment?
No.
Okay, I didn't think
no,
you did.
I don't.
Why not?
Well, when President Obama was first elected and he had the House and the Senate of his party, he could have done this, and he didn't. The reason that immigration reform is so difficult is because the politicians do want it, the leadership wants it, but out in the public, it's very unpopular for a lot of good reasons. And this is a very difficult issue for both parties, and the Republicans should not be blamed for it.
They shouldn't be blamed for it, but would you also acknowledge that I would ask Doug, when Speaker Boehner said that he was going to take it off the table for this year, politically, was that a wise thing for him to say? Because his constituency are House Republicans, and there are very few House Republican districts where there's any significant number of Hispanics. So why would a Republican congressman do something as a favor to the Speaker when the folks back home who will elect them or decide whether they stay in their office if there's a primary, why would they commit political suicide by doing that, at least in a congressional year?
Because it's the right thing to do. And while Speaker Boehner certainly
don't always do the right thing,
he's certainly reacting to his constituency, which is the Tea Party in particular, and the conservative wing of his caucus. But if the Republican Party was being smart and they were doing the right thing, A, for the country, and B, for themselves as a party with a future, they would get behind immigration reform and stand behind it and pass it.
Okay. They probably would do that in a presidential election year. I agree with that. I'm not so sure that it would be the right thing to do in a congressional year, because members of the Republican primary may not vote for those Republicans who vote that way because they may not agree with your assessment that it's a good idea.
The Republicans are voting against this in presidential years and non-presidential years. They're blocking it in all of them.
We got to pause. Back shortly from Culver City. Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Doug Herman, Republican Susan Shelley, and Joel Fox, publisher of Fox and Hounds Daily. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's at BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont, if you'd like to tweet a comment to us. And again, during that break, we received word that CNN has pulled the plug on Piers Morgan. Enough is enough. The ratings were horrendous. He did not click with American audiences. Some suggest because he had a condescending way about him. But anybody want to offer a moment of silence for Piers Morgan's television career? Doug?
For all six people who are watching that show. Here's a moment of silence.
Anyway, any comment on that, feel free to do so. But again, we're talking about bigger ideas, and I know Susan Shelley is one of our guests here this evening. And although you're interested in local politics or statewide politics, there were some thoughts that you had about NSA as well, because that's another issue that is certainly is not gone away. And again, in light of all the problems, the growing in problems between the United States and Russia and Vladimir Putin, obviously Edward Snowden sits, in Russia this evening, perhaps smiling and thinking about what other interesting pieces of information he has to share with the world. But where do you come down on Edward Snowden, and where do you come down on the NSA, and whether or not the president has gone far enough to rein them in his recent directives to the Attorney General?
No, I don't think he's gone far enough. You know, after 9/11, it was certainly understandable that people were alarmed and they felt that something had to be done. But the Fourth Amendment does not allow the government to go rifling through your personal information. It just doesn't. And to collect everyone's metadata, everyone's phone calls, who you called, how long, and hold it forever, I don't believe that it's effective as a weapon against terrorism to have old phone data. I think it opens terrible opportunities for political mischief and other kinds of identity theft and problems. And most of all, just because there's a threat doesn't mean the government can do whatever it wants to do to anyone it wants to do it to. That's not a free country. The Fourth Amendment does not allow that. And, you know, it's always something. It was the Cold War, and it was the Civil War. It was World War I and World War II. We live in a dangerous world. It's always something. The government does not have the power to do whatever it wants. The Fourth Amendment restricts what the government can do to us.
Do you think the nerve that you just touched, again, you're running for the legislature, the General Assembly out here.
Yes.
Is that an issue that would resonate, the level of resonance of that issue?
I think
and so. Your articulation of it.
I think so.
Is that, is that part of the Susan Shelley foreign and domestic national policy?
Well, it's not an issue in California politics,
right.
but privacy is something that people take very seriously, and they don't. No one wants to be open to terrorist attacks, but you know when you have a situation like someone standing up in a military base and shooting people and screaming Allahu Akbar and they say it's workplace violence, what are they doing with all this telephone data if they don't think that's terrorism? It's very disturbing. The way that they're using the information is unknown, and how long they're holding it is unknown. And the Fourth Amendment does not allow it. And the American people have to stand up for their rights.
Susan Rice on Meet the Press today was asked if she knew the whereabouts of the former president of the Ukraine. And she said, no, we really don't know where he is. And I'm saying, they probably could tell me what I had for lunch last night or Joel, where you know the last time you made a call to Northern California. Yeah. But they don't know where this guy is, first of all.
They'll probably know that I actually talked to Doug once in a while and get us both in trouble. But, you know, I'll tell you where it does come into play a little bit out here in California. It's because Apple's here, Google's here, Facebook is here, and these companies are reacting to the pressure of the NSA and the requests that they have made for information out of these companies, and they're trying to both satisfy the requirements from the government and deal with the consumers, their consumers, their customers, who are adverse to this. It's a very interesting political policy question, because it brings together people on the far left and libertarians on the far right, who are both opposed to this.
But in the case of what has been proposed by the president, it doesn't seem that he's saying we're not going to keep the records. He's just saying the government is not going to keep the records. We're going to let the companies that you just mentioned, we're going to let them keep the records. But by the way, when we want to see those records, we'll just get a court order and go in. So isn't that reform without real reform? That's rhetorical reform, not real practical reform, Doug?
Well, I think you have to keep the goal of how do we keep this country safe in mind, and how do we stay on top of these threats. And we found that Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, we got information on that from phone taps. I think that was one of the ways in which we found that. And there's been a lot of other plots that have been foiled.
And the Boston and the Boston bombing.
The Boston bombing, to name a very high-profile one. But there have been a lot of efforts that folks have never seen and never heard about that have been stopped by virtue of these programs. So there is a lot of good to them. There's a lot of things that have been done to protect our country from them. The question is, where is the overreach and how does that get executed?
Well, it's all in secret, so we don't really know. We don't really know what they're doing. We don't know who they're doing it to. And there's so much secrecy, and secrecy protects errors, and it protects corruption. Secrecy protects a lot more than just sources and methods. And if it's going to be secret forever, and we are never going to know what they're doing, how do we really know whether it's doing any good?
But the secrecy... The secrecy does, to some extent, protect us, right? I mean, I said on this program hundreds of times, if not more, during the campaigns of George Bush, after the first campaign, is that you've got to give, whether you like George Bush or not, whether you like Dick Cheney or not, you have to give him, and whether you like John Ashcroft or not, you have to give them credit, because there was not another terrorist attack on the United States other than the one in Boston. There was not another attack on the United States.
Well,
and because of that, one of the reasons was because there was very good intelligence work that was being done that we didn't know about. And had we known about it, it would have certainly compromised any investigation that was going on. And the other thing that I said was, and I believe it, I believe there has to have been, and I think there probably still is, great involvement by the Arab and Islamic communities, Muslim community in the United States, who don't want their religion to continue to be besmirched by radicals. And I'm sure that many of them have cooperated with the FBI in stopping some of these plots.
And
in fact, there were some in Buffalo, New York, I think, where there was some evidence that they were involved. So there's a lot going on that, frankly, Susan, the public shouldn't know about.
But there is a balance to be had, and they have to have a warrant. They have to have probable cause. The United States government does not have the power under the Constitution to search through people's records without any suspicion of them whatsoever, just in case they ever want to look it up for any reason. They don't have the power to do that.
And you think that the general public is still exercised about that?
I think many people are. Many people are upset about this NSA story. Absolutely.
So it's not going to go away.
It's not going away.
So the political power of the NSA as an issue, as Joel said, to a coalition of the left and the libertarian right, that represents a very powerful a political force that has yet to be fully tapped in any electoral way.
That could be.
And that could be one of the things also that makes Rand Paul a perhaps lightning in the bottle. We'll be back shortly from Culver City. Bruce DeMont back in California. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We're live from the Westwood One Studios in beautiful Culver City, California. Let's head to Chicago via the airwaves. Charlotte is listening to us on our flagship station in WLS in Chicago, where it's bitter cold. I'm so sorry I'm not there to put my three layers of coats on tonight, Charlotte, but go ahead.
Okay. A serious issue came up this week. It was pointed out the FCC, Communications Commission, is going to send researchers into newsrooms, radio, TV studios, and even newspapers to decide, I don't know, fairness, minority representation, what is critical information. Should the government be sending its, words have been used, like spies or police, into, these areas of free speech and free press, First Amendment?
Susan, Shelley has a comment.
Well, first of all, the FCC called it off. They're still going to do an investigation of barriers to entry in the communications field, which probably is required by Congress for some reason. But you're absolutely right. The federal government has no power. They have no power to restrict the content of speech. And they have no business asking what the content of speech is going to be or why it was what it was when they have, under the First Amendment, no power, none whatsoever, to control the freedom of the press. You're absolutely right to be alarmed by it. The chilling effect of the government coming in and saying, we want to know why you're saying what you're saying, that should not happen in the United States of America.
Joel?
Absolutely agree. That's a First Amendment issue.
Totally agree. That's why it's not happening.
Okay, we all agree on that. Let's go to Larry, also listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, Bruce, I'm just curious. You were talking about national security a while ago in regard to the NSA spying. I just wonder if anybody on your panel sees the disconnect here between the administration's use of the term national security to collect our phone records, and yet the fact that they will not close the southern border. And we know, documented facts, that there are people who would harm us that are coming across the border. This is not an issue. It's not just guys who want to pick strawberries. It's folks that want to do us harm. And yet when we talk about national security, somehow we get bogged down in this NSA thing, and yet we got an open leak of bad people coming across the Mexican border.
Larry, I think you have to put it in context. There isn't any fence. If you build an 80-foot fence across the entire southern part of the United States, there will be someone that will climb up the 81st floor or 81st foot, and he's going to get over it. So absolute security is impossible. What you do have to look at is the record. The record of enforcement, the record of arrest, the record of deportations, the record of cracking down on illegal immigration and sneaking into this country by this administration. And I have been a critic. You know, it's one of my pet topics. It's been a pet topic of mine for 15 years. But I think we have to put in context that the Obama administration has a fairly, not only fairly good record, they have a good record on cracking down on illegal immigration as it relates to border security. Now, can they do more? Can Congress do more to put penalties on those employees employers that continue to hire people? Absolutely. But again, I think it's almost a knee-jerk thing that would say that, you know, we have a sieve on the southern border. We do perhaps have a sieve, but you know what? It is considerably less of a sieve today than it was 3 years ago, 5 years ago, or 6 years ago. It's getting better. And the other thing is, because of the economic conditions in the United States, there are fewer people living in Mexico that are fleeing to try to get into the country because they're not finding the jobs. So there's two things that happen. But the facts in this particular case would indicate that the Obama administration is doing a pretty good job on controlling the borders as of the moment. Shelley, you may disagree with that, but do you want to just offer an assessment of that? Because obviously this has been a hot-button issue in California, locally and in the state, much longer than it has been a big hot-button issue nationally.
Well, you know, the Inspector General of the IRS complained in 2012 that the law needs to be changed because people are filing tax returns with what's called an ITIN, an Individual Taxpayer ID number, and they're getting tax refunds under it was increased under the 2009 stimulus bill. This is the additional child tax credit and the child tax credit. These are refundable tax credits, which means even if you didn't pay any taxes in, you get a check from the Treasury Department for your tax refund, even though you didn't pay it in. Someone else paid it in, you get the check. And people who are here illegally, working in the country illegally, do not have Social Security numbers, are filing tax returns and legally getting these checks. billions of dollars a year. And the Inspector General of the IRS said something has to be done about this. This is an incentive for people to come into the country illegally, and Congress has ignored it.
But on the issue of border security, would you agree that the track record of the Obama administration is not a bad track record?
I would agree with that. Many, many Hispanic voters that I've spoken to are quite angry at him about deportations.
Doug?
I've heard a lot of complaints about it, too. And frankly, you got to look at the record. And we have not had an attack from the South. And if we're going to do something about that border, the real thing we need to do is immigration reform, real comprehensive immigration reform, not just part and parcel, but we got to do the whole thing. And that's what's going to make that border safer.
By the way, Larry, just on the particular point, the program that we did, the first program we did after 9/11, I was vacationing in Sweden. We did the show live from Stockholm. And in that program, because this issue of illegal immigration has been, as I mentioned, a pet topic of mine for long before it was a fashionable topic on talk shows, I said on that program, the whole world knew that our southern border was a sieve. The whole world knew that. And so that if there were those that wanted to do harm to the United States, as at that particular time, obviously, you know, Arab terrorists, that's the way they were referred to from the get-go, that all they would have to do would be to sneak into the United States via Mexico and just get lost in the populations of America. I can say, and it's been a long time since September 11th, there is no record that I am aware of that there's been any significant organized use of that southern sieve that I've talked about for that purpose. If it's happened, call it to my attention, but it certainly hasn't made any of the major newspapers or media at all. And again, looking at the record of both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, they have all stepped up border security. Now, again, Republican members of Congress will say, "Well, you've got to stop we've got to secure the borders first." Securing the borders is absolutely something we should do, and we should continue to do it. And there's hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent, you know, whether it is drones, whether it is electronic surveillance, there's all kinds of things that are being done at that border. But that doesn't mean that that huge border between the United States and Mexico can't be, penetrated by small groups of people because it's too large. But it's not. We're not talking about thousands of people a day that are flowing into the country. And I think, you know, a few years ago, it wasn't maybe thousands of people, but it was certainly hundreds of people that were coming into the country. I don't think that's the case now. And if there is a Border Patrol officer listening to this program this evening, or anyone involved with real knowledge of what's happening on that border, if you want to call in and dispute what I've just said, please do so. Because I've spent a lot of time on that border. I've spoken with Border Patrol officers. And the last time I spoke with them, they said that things were getting better, not worse. Anyway, we're going to take another call. Let's go to Grant, listening to us in Dallas, Texas, on Sirius XM Radio. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
Good.
I have a quick comment for Susan. There is a Supreme Court case. I'm a new lawyer, and I recently took a class on the Fourth Amendment. And this is about the NSA keeping your phone records. But anyways, there's a Supreme Court case from a while ago. I can't remember the case, but it had to do with phone PIN registers. And the Supreme Court explicitly said that the government can take certain information, like who you're calling and the number that you called and the times that you called, in that case. So I wanted to get her comments on that. And
let's let her respond to that first. Let's let her respond to that first, okay?
What did you say these were? What kind of registers?
PIN registers.
There was a Supreme Court case called PIN registers, where when you call, the phone company can take down or takes down your number so that they can use that to then go, you know, complete your call. And there was a case where police officers wanted that information from the phone company on someone who called, you know, a different number. And the Supreme Court said because you gave your information to a third party, so it's the same thing like if you're giving it in your email, that since you're giving it to a third party company, that you don't have a Fourth Amendment protection in that, and that the government can take that information.
Was this with probable cause and a warrant, or were they just scooping up information?
No, this was not with probable cause, because that was the issue in the case, because the third party had the information themselves, the phone company. Mm-hmm. And so the Supreme Court said that the phone company was the holder of that information. They said that the police would need probable cause if they went into your home and went into that. And there's different issues now with cell phones, and this was back in the 70s. But there have been some big legal scholars who have likened, the current NSA wiretaps, or not wiretaps, but the phone collection data to the same thing, like if the phone company keeps what numbers you have.
Well, I can tell you generally that Fourth Amendment decisions are based on the idea that if there's a compelling need for something, then a state can violate the Fourth Amendment. But this gets into the incorporation doctrine, which is going to get into the weeds, and we don't have time for it. But it could go 5-4 either way if it goes to the court again.
We must pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont, tonight from Culver City, California. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City, California, and during the break, we were picking up on something we discussed in the first hour, and that is this idea that is it definitely going to be an initiative? Is it definitely going to be on the ballot, or we're still waiting? This is the six states. There's some very wealthy guy from Silicon Valley who wants to come up with the idea of six states, dividing California up into six states.
He has followed the formula you must follow to qualify a ballot initiative. He's submitted it to the Attorney General. He's gotten the title and summary, which would go on a petition, and now he's been cleared to start collecting signatures. Whether he takes the next step and tries to seek a million signatures in 150 days, we don't know yet.
What does your gut, again, this is all speculative, we'll start with you, Doug, what does your gut tell you about whether or not, if we walked out of here and we talked to the first 100 people on the street, would they think this is a good idea?
I don't think so. The fact that it's six is the disqualifier for this thing. 25 years ago, I think roughly 25 years ago, there was a ballot initiative to split California into a north and south, two states. And they would have drawn the line somewhere north of Santa Barbara, Santa Maria, up in San Luis Obispo mm-hmm. County. Yeah. And that would have been the north-south split line. It passed. The voters of the state passed it. It was approved by the voters, but of course it went nowhere. And that's the real thing that's going to go on here, if it can even be passed. That six-state thing with the Central Valley being the poorest country in the nation, I think there's a lot of places that are going to be
disqualified. Repeat that again, because you said that one state would be the wealthiest state, which would be Silicon Valley.
The Silicon Valley, the home of the sponsor of this initiative, and then the Central Valley suffering from the drought and California's breadbasket and probably the nation's breadbasket would be sectioned into the nation's poorest state.
But it would be the poorest because of just the drought? I mean,
No, the poverty level is very high. California has one of the highest poverty levels in the United States. In fact, I think it is the highest. So that would be it. But just to clarify, that was an advisory measure. A couple of decades ago. This is actually a constitutional amendment mm-hmm. that would make the change. And historically, by the way, I don't know if we mentioned this in the first hour, but there was a referendum to split the state in 1859, and it also passed, but it went to Congress, and they ignored it. There was a civil war was starting.
Yep. And again, to follow up on what one of the callers in the first hour talked about was that if this was passed, again, Congress would have to approve it.
Yes, they would.
And it's highly unlikely they would do it because it would throw a monkey wrench into the Electoral College.
Electoral College, California's the big party in the Electoral College. 55 electoral votes seem to be in the Democratic column, at least for a while. That would change because some of the way that these six states are constructed, there's probably a couple of Republican states in there, and they would get some of the action. By the way, your question.
So that was basically, although the number may change, the 55 would be divided by six.
That's right. They'd be divided by population. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, right.
But your point when you asked Doug if you went and talked to the first 100 people on the street,
yeah.
And I certainly agree with his answer here. But if you went up maybe to Eureka or Northern California, the state of Jefferson has proposed, you might have a different attitude because they've been talking about breaking away from California for about five decades now. So there might be a little bit more sympathy up there. Not that I think it would pass, but there'd be a little more sympathy up in the northern part of the state.
Susan?
Probably just a
desperate attempt to get people. It's probably just a desperate attempt to get people to stop moving to Texas. They can think they've left the state.
Joel, tell us, everybody, tell those listening a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. I've been involved with California politics for over 30 years. Taxpayer advocate, small business advocate, political consulting.
You've been involved in the Jarvis
initiative. I was with Howard Jarvis himself right after Prop 13 passed. Traveled with him around the country and worked with him on tax issues. I actually was president of his association for a dozen years. And left about 1999 and started doing some consulting, worked with a couple of candidates running for governor here, Richard Ridden, who was the former mayor of Los Angeles, and Arnold Schwarzenegger during the recall campaign. And I now have a blog called foxandhoundsdaily.com, which deals with California business and politics. I write for it, and I have other writers from different perspectives, by the way, on issues in California.
Doug, you're from Iowa. You said that in the first hour. Tell us a little bit more about what got you involved in politics, and what were the first big campaigns that you were involved in this state?
I grew up in Iowa. As I said, I was from a middle-class family, and we were unable to get college student loans when I was in school, and we had three kids in school at the same time, and we were unable to get student loans. So I marched down and joined the Gary Hart for President campaign the first time he ran, so I could help get Ronald Reagan out of office since he'd cut the student loan program, and I've been active and involved in political campaigns ever since.
And you're one of the founders of the Strategy Group, which, again, regular listeners to this program know that your other colleague, Peachy and Greco, has been a guest on the show for many, many years, and he's certainly outspoken. If you just get him to come out of his shell, he'd be a great guest. Susan Shelley. You have run for office.
Yes.
You narrowly lost.
Yes.
And you've learned the lesson of narrowly losing election. You're running again.
I am running
again. Name recognition is up.
I am running again. Well, I only lost by 329 votes out of 30,000 cast, and I was outspent 10 to 1. You were asking earlier about money in politics. It's not everything. I'm originally from Chicago. I want to say hi to all my family and friends listening on WLS and send get well wishes to my Uncle Norty and my Aunt Sylvia, who... She pulled a hamstring. The team still needs her. She's got to recover.
Okay. We've got a caller coming in from Sacramento, which is in the state of Northern California.
North California.
And listening to us on KTKZ, one of our old affiliates. Go ahead. Nice to hear from you tonight. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, good afternoon. The Penn record decision, I believe, occurred in 79. I'm not exactly sure of the date. But I looked into this some time back, and Congress actually overturned that with legislation. There was a privacy law that was enacted in the early 1980s, and which has since been overturned with the Patriot Act. So we're back to the Penn Register ruling being in effect, but it was for a period of time until the Patriot Act was enacted. It was not the law of the land.
Do you think the Patriot Act needs to be amended at this moment?
Oh, of course. And the other thing is, we're always talking about these Penn records, but what about the actual conversations? Are those being stored somewhere? The conversations themselves, because
they say no. They say they're not doing that.
And they say they've alleged that they don't do that at all.
They say they don't.
Well, how can they go back and examine those records? Are they just looking at who called whom, or can they actually listen to the conversations that occurred?
I think what they're trying to do, from their own perspective, what they're trying to do is if a terrorist incident occurs and they know they have a suspect, they want to go back and find out who that person talked to and put together sort of posthumously this network of terrorists that they think they'll find from the phone numbers.
They want to collect the dots
right
after the fact.
They do.
And they think that by having the information, if they've got a court order, they can connect the dots before something happens.
That's what they're trying to do. But
even though they were not able to do anything prior to the Boston bombing, even though those perpetrators were on the radar of American intelligence and Russian intelligence, somehow the dots were not connected prior to Boston.
This gets to what they're doing with the data. Are they doing anything useful, or is this just an electronic version of what's going on at the airports where they're taking away nail clippers from senior citizens and worrying about hip replacements going through metal detectors?
Steve, you're online. You're listening to us on the internet. Go ahead from Los Angeles.
Yeah, I got a prediction for you because you were asking earlier what trend in California is going to spread east.
Yep.
And I also told you that there would be no WMDs found in Iraq, so I have a track record. I predict that the Republicans are going to end up the endangered species that they are in California after 2014, because guess what? America is tired of this party. It has nothing to offer except nothing.
Aw, you hurt my feelings.
Well, let Susan knock it out of the park.
Well, first of all, we need a growing, thriving economy. And the only way we're going to get a growing, thriving economy is to have more economic freedom in this country. We cannot have a command and control. The government decides who's going to have a business and who's going to get a loan and who's going to have to pay a fine for running an engine. We have to have more economic freedom in this country. We need job growth. We need lower taxes. We need less regulation. We need a rational environmental policy in this country. We can't be starving farmers to save bait fish. It's not rational. It's not balanced. And we have to have balance in our California government. One-party rule is very dangerous.
Steve, let me also just elaborate and get you a chance to respond. I want to get Doug's response as well. Right at the moment, the president's approval rating is in the low 40s. It's going down, not up. It has little bumps here and there. But it's not certainly where it was even a year ago. And you have projections, even by objective and even some Democratic pollsters, suggesting that the Democrats are likely to lose control of the United States Senate, and that the House also is highly unlikely that they're going to flip. So I guess my question to you would be, with that sort of overlay of the political climate at the moment, aren't the Republicans, even though they may be perceived by the national media as the party of no, right at the moment, are they not sitting in a pretty good position congressionally? They may be in a problem nationally at the presidential level for 2016, but the political climate at the moment might be swinging towards the Republicans congressionally. Would you acknowledge any of that, Steve?
Bruce, have you seen the Republican disapproval rating lately?
I have, but I'm also looking at...
It's 72%.
I want to get Doug's response. We're going to have to pause for a break. I want Doug to respond to my assessment as well. Steve, thank you very much for your call. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Culver City. From North California to South California to Central California to Jefferson, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. One subject that we've talked about briefly on all of our shows out here is the problems of drought and what are the politics of drought? Who's trying to take advantage of the lack of rain and water out here?
The Republicans seem to try to take advantage of that position because they'll blame the fact that some of the water is not getting particularly down to the Central Valley area, the farm area, on policies that the Democrats created that the environmentalists are pushing. They've complained about the legislation that the California senators Feinstein and Boxer have proposed, that and so they're making an issue out of that. It's the thing, though, you should know, Bruce, is that the water issue in California is not so much ideological, Democrat versus Republican. It's more geographical. It's regional. It's a little bit north versus south than other issues.
Is there truth to what some of the critics are saying? I mean, is the water being used as a
Well,
as
I mean, there are policy debates about water all the time. I mean, I have my perspective. The issue is, should we have more reservoirs, more dams? Environmentalists don't like that. They don't want the dams. But some people argue, well, we have to preserve more water, gather it in a reservoir. That's one of the arguments that goes on constantly here.
But one of the good pieces of news, not necessarily for those that are visiting California, but rain is on the horizon, Doug.
Rain is on the horizon.
For this week. And could be big rain.
it's celebrated here in California, where we've been suffering through a drought, and dust has been more the order of the day than snow or rain or freezing rain. We're looking forward to this drought, or to the drought ending and getting some rain in here. The bottom line here, you know, we've got to do some things. If you listen to the Republicans, they'd have you believe that it's Jerry Brown's fault that it hasn't rained and that's the cause of the drought. But that's simply not true. There's simple...
Have the Democrats blamed it on George Bush yet?
No, but it'd be easy to do because I'm sure there's economic ramifications that go along with this from 08. No, I'm just kidding. The bottom line is, you know, we've got to do some smarter things. It doesn't make sense to use all of the water that we can to flood fields and keep the plants drowned in water so we can grow rice in a desert. That's absolutely absurd that we're doing things like that and we're using the amount of water to do something like that. The battle is a north-south battle, but it's also an environmentalist battle over the farmers, and there's a lot of different things that go into this, and it does cut ideologically. It does cut geographically. It's a long and tortured fight in this state.
Susan?
Well, we have overlapping regulation, which is running on autopilot, and it's out of control. We have the EPA, and we have the Air Resources Board here in California, and we have all these different things. For instance, we have 30 billion gallons of drinking water a year that Los Angeles ratepayers are paying to pour on a dry lake bed in Owens Valley, on the Owens Lake. That's a Rose Bowl a day of water. That's as much as the city of San Francisco uses in a year. And in the middle of a severe drought, Los Angeles ratepayers are paying to pour that drinking water on a dry lake bed to hold down dust.
During the last several shows that we've done here, there's been general agreement, even from some of the Republicans who've been here, that Jerry Brown, the governor, is probably sailing to re-election. Do you agree with that?
I think what's going to happen is what happened in 2003, which is after the election, the real budget news is going to come out and people are going to be livid. You probably don't remember that Gray Davis was recalled because all of a sudden everything was fine before the election and he hid all this information from the voters. And right afterwards, there was a hike
in the car
tax.
What's the information that he's hiding in your view?
There's $354 billion of debt and unfunded liabilities that are not being considered in what they are calling a balanced budget. And most of that is pensions and health benefits for state workers and teachers and other retirees.
We're familiar with that issue in Illinois and other states.
And $8.8 billion that we owe the federal government for the unemployment checks that would bounce otherwise in California because there isn't enough money to pay for all the people who are collecting unemployment because the economy isn't good here.
Another issue that he's closely associated with is the bullet train. What is the controversy involving the bullet train? Why does he want it so much?
I don't know why he wants it. We should cancel the bullet train. This is a $68 billion project.
Where's the money coming from?
Nobody knows, and that's the problem. There were going to be about
federal money?
Well, there's like $3 billion of federal money. It's a $68 billion project. It was sold to the voters as a 2.5-hour ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and now it's going through the Central Valley, and it's a blended rail system. It's not a bullet train at all. It's a boondoggle. Lovely artist's renderings, though, of blue trains with yellow stripes going through wind farms. Very pretty. They'd look nice on your wall.
Boondoggle, Joel?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a boondoggle. I think it. I think it's part of the legacy that the governor wants to leave behind. It was passed. When it was passed, they said it was going to cost $33 billion. Then it went up to $100 billion. And when there was an outrage over that, they dropped it down to $68 billion. But the money's not there. And Congress...
Does it create a lot of jobs?
It creates some jobs, certainly, but it doesn't live up to what the voters were promised in the ballot measure. And a judge has so said and said, you've got to come up with a better plan. And so far, I don't think they've met the judge's satisfaction.
Where's the funding coming from, Doug?
Well, that's the problem. They don't have a funding source identified for it. And the cost of this has ballooned far beyond its initial estimate.
Should it be stopped?
Yes.
Well, it's hard to make the argument that it should continue without funding. That's for certain. And they don't have a funding stream identified. And they're searching around for that.
Are there Democrats in the general?
You know what happened this week? The lieutenant governor, a Democrat, came out and said it should be stopped. And he said he's willing to speak out publicly, but there are other Democrats who agree with him. That's a big move.
Are they going to do it?
We'll have to wait and see. It just happened this week. But the lieutenant governor has stood by his words that he did on a radio program that he said that this should not be funded. The money should be used elsewhere.
That was Joel Fox. Fox and Hounds is the website that he runs. Susan Shelley has been with us. She is running for the California Assembly, again, as a Republican from Woodland Hills area. And also joining us this evening is Doug Herman from the Strategy Group, again, Democratic political consultant. Thank you all very much for being with us tonight. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago, as well as Westwood One here in Culver City. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz back in Chicago, and also Ted Woods and Corey Irwin for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from California.